It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We often hear that lower-income individuals have to prioritize the necessities, food, shelter, health care. But where does dental care fall on that list? Organizers from Mission of Mercy Pittsburgh are conducting their third annual free dental clinic today and Saturday at PPG Paints Arena. Dr. Daniel Petuch is the co-founder of Mission of Mercy. Keith Young is chairman of A Call to Care, the sponsor of Mission of Mercy. I spoke to them yesterday as they were setting up for the clinic. Dan, let me start with you. How was it determined that there was a need for what became a huge free clinic?
Well, the ADA has recognized this for many, many years, and there are missions that occur around the country. And 4 years ago, it came to Pittsburgh, and we had overwhelming response. The community recognized that there was a need for this, and we did studies. We saw that the emergency rooms in Pittsburgh at Presby and Shadyside receive over 3,000 visits a year just for dental-related emergencies. And so because of the response and because of the support of the community, we've been able to now have this on an annual basis here in Pittsburgh.
Keith, have you seen the demand grow even over the last couple of years?
Yeah, we have. In fact, last year we did about 1,100 patients and had about 1,200 volunteers. With that said, we closed the doors each morning at 9:30 a.m. on the two clinic days, so we didn't get to all the patients that we need. So this year, we went from 80 dental chairs to 100 dental chairs, and we have 1,450 volunteers with 180 dentists right now. So we're hoping to get as many patients through as we possibly can.
Dan, I believe you surveyed your patients at last year's clinic. Is it common for people to put off dental care?
Well, it is. It's actually, you talked about a priority list. Dental care frequently is at the very bottom of that list. However, when someone develops a problem because of decay or an abscess or an infection, it quickly rises to the top of that priority list. And when the pain is very severe, everything stops and it becomes the number one priority. But for individuals that are working multiple jobs or have a lot of expenses because of family or in between jobs, it becomes difficult to access that care. And our hope is to be able to provide care on an annual basis so that at least individuals in this situation can count on it every year.
Yeah, just to add to that, when we do the survey, one of the questions that we ask is of the patients is, how long have you had dental pain? Last year, 45% had dental pain for a year or more.
Many people don't have insurance or lack easy access to it. Are there any income or eligibility requirements for someone that wants to take advantage of this clinic?
No, there are no requirements at all. You just show up and whatever you need, we try to help you with. Now, you go through a process that you go through medical triage to make sure that you're physically able to go through the process. Then you go through dental triage to see what needs to be done. We do a lot of different procedures, but there are some that we don't do.
Dan, give us an idea of just some of the procedures that will be performed.
Well, we will be able to actually perform everything from root canals, which is endodontic therapy, to fillings and restorations on teeth, to even making partial dentures for people missing teeth. We're going to have a large surgery section providing extractions, and we're going to also have a hygiene section that's going to be providing dental cleanings, and we'll have a radiology section doing x-rays, and so it's a pretty comprehensive clinic.
Is this clinic a rarity in its size, in its focus? Dan, we'll start with you.
These clinics occur in every state, but this one is unique because it's anchored in one city every year on an annual basis. So that makes it rare, and it's a large clinic compared to other clinics that occur around the country.
Yeah, it is special for what Dan just said. The size is different. We want to make sure this is an annual event for people. But what's really becoming very good for us is this is becoming a community event. We're in our third year, and we now have the support of some very strong corporations in Pittsburgh that are providing help for us. So it's becoming a really neat community event.
You mentioned all the services that will be offered, that are being provided over the course of these 2 days. What advice or what information do you provide regarding follow-up care?
Well, along with the dental care, we're actually going to have a fully equipped pharmacy staffed with pharmacists who will be providing discharge medications as prescribed by the doctors providing the care. The patients will also receive written post-op instructions where appropriate, and they will have a phone number that will be available for emergency aftercare. And dentists and surgeons have also volunteered to see patients after procedures in the event that they have a problem following the event.
Dan, can dental problems lead to other issues, other health issues?
We now know that there are definitely correlations between dental problems and poor dental health and overall health. We know that pathogens from the oral cavity can access the bloodstream, and they can lodge themselves on valves and create an endocarditis. These abscesses in the oral cavity can also spread to the neck, to the brain. I've seen it go to the orbit, to the eye socket. So these infections can become serious acutely, but chronically, the low-grade pathogens that may be in your blood and you don't know about it are altering blood vessels and other systems within your body over a long period of time. So it's we're learning more and more that it's a very critical component to overall good health.
You gentlemen have been involved since the beginning. Is there a story, a comment that one of the patients, just left with you that sort of stands out, that sums up why you wanted to do this in the first place? Keith?
There are many, and not only do we get the stories, but the volunteers get stories all day long because these people are so grateful. But there is one story from last year that at the end of the Saturday, I was standing cleaning up, and there was this woman. She was taking some fruit. We have fruit, and she was filling up her bag, and she just walked up and said, "You've saved me." And I said, "Tell me your story." And she said, "I saved up for a year and a half, $500, to have some dental work done that I needed. When they were done with that, they told me I need a root canal for $1,200. And she said, I had no way of how to figure out how to make that happen. And then she literally said, "Thank you, because I came here, you did the root canal for me, you saved me this money, and I have a better dental situation." And then gave me a big hug.
I actually talked to a volunteer who was a patient ambassador, and she was actually helping a patient through the clinic. This was an elderly lady who needed a significant amount of assistance. This volunteer took her through the stations, got her the care that she needed, got her out of pain, and then even helped her get home safely. At the end of it all, she took her rosary off of her, told her that it was her grandmother's, and gave it to her as a token of her appreciation. So it was fairly profound to hear that story from this volunteer.
Dr. Dan Patuch is co-founder of Mission of Mercy Pittsburgh. Keith Young is the chairman of A Call to Care, sponsoring Mission of Mercy Pittsburgh. Gentlemen, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Republican Committee of Allegheny County has elected Sam DeMarco as its new chair. The county councilor is a North Fayette native and succeeds Dee Raja, who stepped down earlier this year. DeMarco spoke with 90.5 WESA's Chris Potter about how he plans to strengthen the Republican Party in Allegheny County.
As I understand it, you're a Pittsburgh kid. Am I right about that?
Yes, sir. I was born and raised on Mount Washington and then Beachview before joining the Marine Corps when I was 17 years old.
Typically, Beachview kid, Mount Washington kid, they don't grow up to be Republicans. Were you sort of the black sheep in the family, or how did it come that you came to be a Republican?
Pretty much. My mother was actually a Democrat committee woman, and my dad was a Teamster, ran for business agent of Local 249. What happened was I was always interested in politics at a young age. In high school, I was a member of Student United Nations and things like that, and I was always strong on national security. Democrats were traditionally weak on that, so when I joined the Marine Corps at 17, when I became 18 years old and was eligible to vote, I registered as a Republican and have been a Republican ever since.
How did the folks take that?
Oh, they were fine with it. I was the oldest of six kids. You know, they had five others to work on to try to fix those mistakes.
And yet, here you are, having reached the lofty heights of county council and the committee. I have to say, this is a profile of a person who will take a thankless job. You are now the top elected Republican in county government. So what do you think the role of county council is? Is it living up to its potential? What does it need to be doing differently, if anything?
When folks come to me and they say, Sam, county council votes with Rich Fitzgerald 98% of the time. You guys are a rubber stamp. I say, well, what piece of legislation did you want me to vote against? The overwhelming majority of what we deal with is just regular business. You know, it's moving a transfer of money from one budget bucket to another. It's allowing somebody to use county property on the big things I've fought the battle against. You have folks that are pushing a civilian police review board. It's going to be used as a tool where they can put activists on there to sort of get a second bite at the apple if they don't get the results they want from the district attorney. In this chairman's race, which just concluded, I had folks out there that were posting on Facebook pictures of me, and then they put a picture of the county executive or the mayor or a congressman, and they were calling it Sam's Club. And they were saying that because I got a picture with a Democrat that I wasn't fit to serve as a county chairman. These are people that don't seem to realize that in order to get things done on behalf of the people, you need to work together. When you're there with 11 Democrats, there's four Republicans, you're limited in what you're going to be able to accomplish. So I'm focusing with a pragmatic approach.
Let's talk about why you decided to to run at all. Because again, talk about high on the list of thankless jobs in this region. Republican chair of Allegheny County would seem to be one. What made you want to take this job in the first place?
I saw us losing relevance. I mean, you know, this year here, there were seven county council seats up and there were five of them that we didn't have a candidate for. Row office. We didn't have a candidate on the ballot for three of the four. You know, we ran somebody on write-in, but she wasn't on the ballot. You know, we had one person running, Matt Droz, running in the county executive spot. This isn't an aberration. We've done the same thing in 17 and in 15. We have 264,000 registered Republican voters in Allegheny County, more than any other county in the state. And we wonder, why don't they come out to vote? Well, you have to have a candidate to come out to vote for if you want them to come out to vote. I thought we were risked losing an entire generation of young conservative voters. And also, we have the president's election next year, or re-election, I should say. It's important that we turn out in Allegheny County, and I couldn't continue to allow this to continue. When you look at the state of Pennsylvania, the East is going to vote Democrat, the T is going to vote Republican, and what we're able to do here in Western Pennsylvania is going to determine the winner of statewide elections and presidential races.
What we saw in 2018, a lot of us looked at those results and said, one challenge Republicans have really got is in college-educated suburbs where, frankly, people were on the fence about the president even in 2016. And in 2018, I think you saw a lot of votes kind of go the other direction from a lot of those communities. So how do you kind of connect with folks in those communities in particular going into 2020 there? Because it seems like a big challenge for you.
Listen, there's always a challenge, all right? So we need to make the case to them that our policies will in fact deliver better results for they and their families, you know, than the Democrats. Let's look at that. The unemployment rate here in Allegheny County is 3.8%. It's the lowest it's been since we started recording it in 1976. We need to change the messaging and focus on what the results are, stay away from the tweets, talk about the policies and how it matters to the average voter and their families.
I'm just going to flaunt what you just said and focus on the tweets for a second, Sam, because I'm curious. Oh, shit, you follow the president on Twitter.
Absolutely.
So when you see some of these tweets, so for example, as you know, the ones where he kind of suggested that the squad, as they call them, the four female members in the House, and he says, you know, they come from these countries that, you know, are complete and total catastrophes. Why don't they go back and help fix the totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came? You wake up in the morning, roll over, and you see those tweets. What's your reaction to that? And then kind of make the case for why somebody who worries that it really reflects a racial animus on the part of the president, what they should make of that.
You know, perhaps he expresses himself sometimes in ways that I might not express myself. One of the reasons why Republicans support him is because he's not afraid to say what he means, all right? We understand this is a guy he's been running his own business his entire life, used to shooting from the hip, not being called to account on anything. So we give him leeway, you know, for some of those things. He's absolutely not a racist.
when you turn on your TV and you see footage of, you know, the detention camps down along the border, and you see these folks in what are really terrible conditions, and then you sort of look at the president's rhetoric, it's hard not to see a sort of connection between those things.
The Democrats are against doing anything, setting up walls or providing the additional security or anything to stop this incredible inflow of people trying to get to the United States. And the president's frustration is borne out by, you have millions of people risking their lives trying to get to this country. And we have these four women in Washington running around talking about how terrible we are. A frustration born out of that and saying, hey, America, love it or leave it, is not a racial or a racist type statement.
The criticism that they've been trash talking America. We heard Mr. Trump, when he was a candidate, talk about this country as a place other countries were laughing at, as a, you know, this just blight of urban, you know, devastation or whatever. I mean, it was a pretty dark picture of the United States. I mean, this is a president who said, when he was asked about Putin being a killer on the Fox Network, if I recall correctly, he said, hey, you think America is so innocent? I mean, if Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said something like that, people would go crazy about it, wouldn't they?
Well, you know, I will tell you this. When the president was running, he said things that I didn't agree with. However, when you're talking about something, you say, how can we be the wealthiest country on earth? And our inner cities are falling apart. That's one thing, as opposed to these four talking about how racist or sexist or misogynistic or homophobic or Islamophobic, or you pick whatever phobic they come up with. But there's a vast difference there, in my opinion. At the end of the day, I believe everybody should have a choice. Whether they decide that these ideas are the right ones for them or not, that's up to the voters. It's up to us to make that case.
That was Sam DeMarco, the new chair of the Republican Committee of Allegheny County, speaking with WESA's Chris Potter. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence, a conversation with Elaine Arrington, who became the first African-American woman to graduate from Pitt School of Engineering. And immigrant advocates in Pittsburgh say sharing reports of immigration and customs enforcement agents on social media might not be the best course of action. What should you do when ICE knocks on your door? Find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. Picklesburg is back this weekend, and with an expanded footprint. The pickle-themed event takes place each year on the Clemente Bridge, but can get a bit crowded. This year, it will extend to include three blocks of Fort Duquesne Boulevard and will feature even more vendors. And Pittsburghers got their first look at Tom Hanks' Mr. Rogers this week. The first trailer for the Fred Rogers biopic, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, was released Monday. It features beautiful panoramas of downtown Pittsburgh, WQED's Oakland Building, and Hanks' uncanny resemblance to Rogers. Find more top stories online at WESA.fm.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In 1961, Elaine Arrington became the first African-American woman to graduate from the University of Pittsburgh School of Engineering. She went on to be the first female aerospace engineer at an Air Force base in Ohio, in charge of determining how Soviet aircraft were outperforming American aircraft during the height of the space race. Arrington recently spoke before the screening of the movie Hidden Figures at the Carnegie Science Center. She told 90.5 WESA's Sarah Schneider she first recognized her mathematic abilities in high school.
I think I had that aha moment in a geometry class. When we were given problem to work on, and the senior class president got us all together, there was a problem that we could not solve. So he said, well, when we go tomorrow, we will tell Mr. Conde that we can't solve the problem. Mr. Conde was a tough nut, I'll tell you. So I went home, and I just couldn't forget the problem. So I worked and worked and worked, and I tried it this way and that way. And after a while, everything started clicking, and I could see I was writing this out just like they do in the book. And we got in class the next day. Mr. Conley asked us about that problem. So I timidly raised my hand and said, Mr. Conley, I think I can solve it. He never smiled, but I could just see the smile forming on his face. And when I got to the end, he said, good job, Arrington. The senior class president said, well, Mr. Conley, right there at the end when she said this and that, those 3 steps. Couldn't she have done it in 2? And I felt devastated because he was right. I could have done it in 2 steps. But Mr. Conley looked at him and said, after she's carried you across the river, you say, put me down, I can swim. I realized then that I could do that and that I could probably do more by myself than I could do in a committee, and that I would never let somebody, you know, stop me from thinking and solving a problem. There's always another way to look at it. If you have that aha moment and you know you can do it, then I think that is should be the impetus to continue.
And you did continue. You went on to study engineering at the University of Pittsburgh, and then you worked at an Air Force base in Ohio as an aerospace engineer. And that was really during the height of the space race, right, in the early 60s. So what was that like?
Well, that was really fun. I mean, everything we did was at least secret. Every now and then we get something that was top secret. We worked in a vault. I mean, you had to be locked in and out. Because when they take the reconnaissance data, the secret data, we can see, like, the physical characteristics of the airplane. Then we would try to decide, well, what was the power plant? What were they using for their engine? All of those things, we would sit down and try to decide, okay, and they must be using these missiles, and if they try to do a mission with those air-to-air missiles that we think they have, what will they be able to hit and kill? So it was a matter of trying to predict what kind of impact they could have if they had what we thought they had from what we saw from the data.
So then you went on to teach mathematics at the University of Pittsburgh for more than 40 years. When you were teaching, did you notice the demographics of your students change over time?
Some, but not nearly what I hoped for or expected. And I'm interested in seeing how this Generation Z turns out, how the culture developed them. So I'll wait and see, and hopefully I'll be here to see it.
That was Elaine Arrington speaking with 90.5 WESA's Sarah Schneider. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Self-driving cars could change the world, but Pittsburgh residents and officials have only just begun to talk together about how they may change the city. 90.5 WESA's Marker J. Krause reports a discussion between council members and experts this week revealed the yawning divide between technological advances and public policy.
Good afternoon and welcome to Pittsburgh City Council's Cablecast Post Agenda.
Councilor Teresa Kale-Smith called the meeting to order. The panel of experts explained how autonomous vehicles may affect air quality or the way streets are designed or where people live. And then they took questions. Councilor Corey O'Connor asked Laura Weens of Pittsburghers for Public Transit to clarify what it could mean to commute without having to watch the road.
Did you say we want people to live further away?
No, I'm saying that's one of the goals.
Yeah, because
not one of the goals, one of the outcomes.
It was a little bit like watching C-SPAN last year as members of Congress questioned Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg. Here's Republican Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah.
How do you sustain a business model in which users don't pay for your service?
Senator, we run ads.
Like Facebook's operations, autonomous vehicles are complicated, and legislators aren't technologists. That policy lags behind the latest advancements is thus far the way of the world. But a lack of knowledge didn't keep city officials from embracing self-driving technology. Companies have tested autonomous vehicles in Pittsburgh since 2016. On September 14th of that year, Mayor Bill Peduto tweeted an image of himself, grinning in the backseat of the, quote, first-ordered autonomous vehicle ride. But the initial gung-ho endorsement soured over questions of what the company owed the city. After a 2018 fatality in Arizona, Uber halted testing in Pittsburgh. Meanwhile, the number of self-driving outfits here grew quietly to 5. Despite public misgivings, Peduto said last year that autonomous vehicles are inevitable.
Every company in the world is moving to shared, electric, autonomous, and connected vehicles.
For residents near the Mon Oakland Mobility Project, that future feels imminent. A system of autonomous micro-shuttles was floated as a way to directly connect Oakland with Greenfield and Hazelwood via Schenley Park.
Nothing about us without us!
A small group of residents gathered on the steps of the city-county building this spring to protest the idea.
We've got dreams bigger than AVs!
Ziggy Edwards lives in the Run. She worried the city was only interested in being on the cutting edge.
They seem very determined to do what they originally wanted and not really seriously consider any other alternative.
The Mon Oakland project would affect a small segment of Pittsburgh's population, but the policy implications could eventually affect thousands, and that raises a lot of questions. What kinds of data will such a system collect? Who will be able to afford on-demand transit? Will people with disabilities be able to use it? How many bus drivers lose their jobs? And to O'Connor's question, will people use commute time to sleep or catch up on email? Will they live in Erie and commute to Pittsburgh? What does that mean for the city's tax base? Karina Ricks directs the Department of Mobility and Infrastructure. She says they finally have the resources to engage deeply with the public on these very issues. As far as autonomous shuttles and the Mon Oakland plan go, Ricks now says they got ahead of themselves. While a shuttle is still a possibility, it would be commanded by a human.
Today, in 2019, and likely in 2020, and 2023, and 2027, there is no such thing as an autonomous shuttle. The technology is not there yet.
Representatives from Argo AI, Aurora Technologies, and Uber all echoed the idea that the technology isn't ready yet for widespread deployment. Aurora CEO Chris Urmson says driverless technology will be a net benefit to society and prevent millions of car crashes.
We're not a company that is about building technology for technology's sake. It's about building this transformational technology, doing that safely, and working with the community, working with our partners.
Advocates, companies, and city officials all say there's so much yet that has to be worked out. Pittsburgh still has time to do so, but no time to waste. I'm Margaret J. Krause, 90.5 WESA News.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Raids began last week by Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers targeting migrant families. According to ICE, as of late Tuesday, 35 people had been arrested nationwide. Immigrant advocate organizations, including Casa San Jose here in Pittsburgh, say these announced investigations are scare tactics. Joining us in studio are the executive director of Casa San Jose, Monica Ruiz, the organization's emergency response organizer, Laura Perkins, and community organizer, Veronica Lozada. Welcome to The Confluence. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
So despite the announcement of a large-scale effort, not many people have been detained. Do you know of any activity or arrests in Pittsburgh? Laura?
So far, no. We are staying vigilant and we are staying in contact with the community. We have an emergency response phone number where people can call if they believe someone was detained. And so far in Pittsburgh, we haven't heard of any.
There have been photos shared online of ICE vehicles parked outside the Home Depot in East Liberty. Others have talked about sightings in Shadyside and Dormont, I believe. Is there a confirmed ICE presence, though, in the Pittsburgh area?
ICE has been present in Pittsburgh for a while, so this is not anything necessarily different. We are noticing some reports of different types of vehicles, and we're staying on top of that, but ICE has been detaining people in Pittsburgh for years.
Has that presence changed? Is it more visible or not? Does it become more visible when an announcement is made about nationwide raids?
So I think that the answer to that is yes. And the reason is that it is really a scare tactic. The more that ICE is showing others that there is a presence, they are also kind of fulfilling this idea that they're out there doing their jobs and they're out there being more vigilant.
Veronica?
The community is more scared because of the social media, the rumors. Most of it is the rumors that they're hearing, you know, is not really happening.
A national sweep was supposed to happen in June, but that was canceled when the locations, the cities that were being targeted were leaked. And even President Trump talked about them on Twitter. If you're law enforcement and considering a raid, you'd think the element of surprise would be important. What do you make of all this information out that's put out there?
It's just a way to keep people scared. It's a way for him to talk to his base so that they think he's running for re-election, right? So he's having people believe that he's going to fulfill all the things that he said when he campaigned the first time.
Veronica, ahead of the proposed raids, what was your sense of the feeling within the community? Did you receive any concerned calls or requests for, you know, verified information?
Yes, we constantly are receiving calls. We constantly are having families come into our office. And what I'm reading to the community is mostly fear. The fear and the insecurity, you know, what will happen every day on their lives. Their fear to go to work, their fear to go to school, their fear to go to the park, their fear just to take a walk on the street and not be able to come back home for their families.
Laura, you mentioned no arrests here in the Pittsburgh area that you know of. If a raid were to occur, Casa San Jose has a rapid response plan. How does it get activated? What happens? Who's leading the charge?
Sure. So usually what happens is that a community member calls our rapid response number that is 24/7. And when we determine that someone has been detained, we have volunteer attorneys and volunteers that speak Spanish go down to Pittsburgh's ICE office and try to get as much information as we can get and provide that information to the family so that we can then provide services to the family.
Mm-hmm. Have you had to do that much?
Yeah, I'm kept pretty busy. I get phone calls a decent amount. And sometimes it's a false alarm, but a lot of times it's not. Pittsburgh ICE is very active and has been well before this national project or this national impulse. They've been detaining people for a while.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're here with representatives of Casa San Jose, the executive director, Monica Ruiz, community organizer, Veronica Lozada, and emergency response organizer, Laura Perkins. Social media can play a big part in this, right? Warning about officer sightings or even touting advice for immigrants and allies. Can social media play a helpful role in all of this? Monica?
Yes, it can. It actually can, but it has to be done correctly. And so we hold Know Your Rights sessions not only for our community members, but for allies as well. We have information on our website. If anyone has any questions, they can call. They can come into the office. But we need the correct information going out, because if not, all it does is cause total chaos.
And I'd like to add that resharing a post on a potential sighting is not helpful, because as things are reshared, we lose the original information. So that we really discourage resharing, but just bringing the information to Casa San Jose is much better.
So say an ICE agent does knock on someone's door. What should they do? Monica?
If someone knocks on your door, you should definitely ask to see if they have a warrant. And we take a long time to explain the differences between the two different types of warrants. One is a judicial warrant, which is signed by a judge. One is an administrative warrant, which in often cases isn't valid at all. And so if the warrant is signed by a judge, if it has the name of the person and the person is in the home, and if it has the correct address, then you must produce that person.
I'd like to add that you should not open the door under any circumstances. The warrant can be passed either under the door or it can be shown in the window, but the second the door is open, it's a slippery slope. So the door should not be opened even during the speaking between the two parties.
Mm-hmm. If ICE is knocking on your door, the first thing to do is please call us. Please call us. We can walk you through it. We can go. We can help. We can do whatever we can. But please do not make a mistake.
I'd like to point out that a lot of the arrests aren't happening at the door of homes. A lot of them are outside their homes, usually either on the street or in vehicles. So I just wanted to give that piece of information.
Mm-hmm. And also, I would like to add to be aware that on that order, be sure that your name is spelled correctly and it's real your name. Because being times that they have an order, but it's maybe your name, but it's a different last name. So be aware that you check that your name really match.
Also, if they have an immigration attorney already, that is an important call to make.
Mm-hmm. You've walked people through, but how much of that is the legal process? Maybe how much of your role is also maybe calming people down?
Of course. Yeah, absolutely. That's an important element. Staying calm during any type of detention really helps diffuse the situation and not escalate it.
How concerned are people right now? Can you give us a sense, Veronica, of the level of concern in general?
There is no words to describe the concerns and the pain and how afraid they live in their lives every day. They shouldn't be living like this. You know, this is just affecting not just one person. It's affecting the whole family, the whole community, because we are like one whole community together. So it is very, very stressful for them to be living like that. You know, it's not healthy.
Is there a concern of people who might not have documents but have not been ordered to leave either at this point? Monica.
That's exactly who is concerned because, to be honest, we have very, 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 very few folks that would fall under this category that have been ordered deported and haven't left. The vast majority are in this other category that would be like collateral pickups, people who just are here without proper documentation and get picked up.
Under the previous administration, the people that were targeted were the only people that were detained. But when Monica says collateral pickups, it's that if they're targeting one person, they will grab anyone in the area that they suspect might also not have documents. And so it's very confusing when people give a ride to their coworkers and four people are detained, and it's hard to figure out the connections between them and why they were targeted, because they weren't, but they were collateral pickups.
What about Latinos in our region who are citizens, who are here legally? Is there concern that they might be targeted just because of their presentation?
Absolutely. It's happening all around the country. People are being picked up and detained, whether they're documented or not. I mean, our local ICE office, at best, could probably speak maybe 10 words in Spanish. And if somebody doesn't speak English, it's very easy for somebody to get picked up.
Personally, as an immigrant myself, I do fear of my security every day. I carry with me my documents because I'm afraid that one day I will be stopped. And I shouldn't be feel afraid. And imagine, you know, people that don't have the documents, and because if your color of your skin is different, or you have an accent, or you look different, you can be a target of that persecution.
So normally, you wouldn't be carrying your documents with you.
Exactly, that's correct. Normally, I would be just going to work like another day, but lately, I'm very fearful myself. And as myself, as a lot of citizens of this country are fearing every day, you know, you're concerned that you don't want to have that situation where you're getting pulled over.
What would you suggest, each of you, to people if they see ICE agents in their neighborhood? What is the best advice you can give people?
Please contact Casa San Jose. That's really all I ask. The emergency response phone number is 412-736-7167. And that is the number that if I receive a phone call or a text, I act on that immediately. So if people want to use that number, they're welcome to contact this number. But resharing on social media really just helps to spread the fear.
Yeah. So to our community in particular, being prepared, learning as much as you can, knowing your rights, you have the right to record anything that happens. Please do. And please help us so that our communities aren't living in fear.
Veronica?
And also be vigilant, you know, watch each other. Watch if anything happened to your neighbor, watch if anything happened to your friends, or anything happening on the street. If you're passing through, please, as Monica say, record any illegal movement that happened. And be informed. Don't believe what everything is showing on the social media. Inform yourself first on the facts before acting.
Veronica Lozada is a community organizer, Laura Perkins is the emergency response organizer, and Monica Ruiz is the executive director of Casa San Jose. Thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you for having
Thank
us.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, the Peduto administration says the legal challenges to a new gun ordinance erroneously claims the city law is a ban. Plus, a victory in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court as the city requires businesses to provide paid sick leave. If you missed anything from today's program, or if you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance by Julia Zenkovich, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good weekend of good news.